welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the Golden Age of Radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. In this hour, Mystery. Later on, we'll hear Nightbeat from 1950, but right now, Dick Powell and the forerunner to his famous series, Richard Diamond, Private Detective, Rogues Gallery. This NBC broadcast first heard on June 23, 1946, called The Star of Savoy.
Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogues Gallery. For the benefit of those who tuned in hoping to hear Cass Daly, may I introduce myself? My name is Richard Rogue. I'm a private investigator. I said it and I'm glad. Private investigator. That's the Harvard way of saying I'm a guy who has parlayed a hard head and a great curiosity about other people's affairs into a career. At least that's the way the Homicide Squad's Lieutenant Urban, who shares my interest in unalive bodies, feels about me. And I'd also better tell you now that I have a certain personal idiosyncrasy. I hold audible consultations with my alter ego once in a while when I'm confused and in need of advice. His name is Ugor, which is Rogue spelled backwards, and he's a very fresh little spook. Of course, I wouldn't have known I had an alter ego if Betty Callahan, the girl I would rather be marooned on a desert island with than not, hadn't browbeaten me into reading Sigmund Freud. Betty, who is the sharpest newspaper woman in town, extends upward about 5 feet from the floor, has hair the color of cordovan leather and firelight, and a tip-tilted Irish nose shying away from the most kissable mouth in the world. She's wonderful. And on this day I'm going to tell you about, she and I had had lunch together. She had an hour to kill, so she walked back to my office with me.
You know, Richard, this is much too nice a day to work.
Look, Betty, if you can get rid of that assignment you have for this afternoon, we'll go to the races, huh?
Oh, I haven't been out this year.
I got some information from Herb Hyde at the cigar store in the lobby. He gave me two horses who gave him their word they were ready today.
Talking horses?
Only to Herb. They don't speak English, but fortunately he speaks horse. Now get on the phone and ask that slave driver at your city desk for the afternoon off. Tell him you have to go to your grandmother's wedding or something.
Well, I'll try, but it's not going to work, and I know it.
Just sit right down there and pay no attention to that sign asking you to leave a nickel in the cigar box for every call.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, it's nothing. It's nothing. I'll do anything for the girl I love.
Better think of something better than my grandmother's wedding. I know. I'll tell him I want to go to the race.
Okay, but...
You're Richard Rogue?
Yeah.
A detective in New York named Clement Cohan referred me to you. My name is Charles McDonald.
Yeah, I got his letter.
I got to see you right away.
Go on in that office there. I'll be in a minute.
All right. Please, hurry.
What was the matter with him? He looked sick.
Well, probably been drinking. I noticed that from the...
Oh, wait a minute. Hello, give me the city desk, please.
Now, make it a good story. Tell him it's your grandmother.
Hello, Walter. This is Betty Callahan. Look, can you put somebody else on that Subel story this afternoon? I want to go to the races. But, Walter... Yes, okay.
What did he say?
No.
Oh.
He told me to get right back to the paper, and I like my job, so here I go.
Oh, well, then wait a minute. I'll go in and talk with this guy, give him a quick brush and go over with you. Maybe I can talk Walter into letting you take the afternoon off for the betterment of racing, huh?
Well, you'll have to hurry. Walter's mad.
Well, just take it easy. I'll be right back. Hey. Hey, what's the matter? Oh, good Lord, Betty.
Richard, what happened? Oh, he fell out of his chair.
Yeah. Get Urban on the phone and call him for an ambulance.
Oh, Rich. He's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, very dead. I should be inured to the sight and smell of sudden death by this time, but it always does something to me. It freezes my stomach and gives me a dull ache at the base of my brain. When I left Betty Callahan on the phone in my reception room and walked into my private office, I found my mysterious visitor falling forward out of his chair in death. I knelt by his side and loosened the long top coat he was wearing. The front of his suit and his shirt were red, and there were two bullet holes. One to the right of his heart, and one a little below it. I tried to blame myself for not talking to him at once, for not understanding that his staggering, shuffling gait was not caused by drinking, but by loss of blood. I looked in his billfold for identification. His name was Charles McDonald, and he was assistant manager of a Park Avenue jewelry store in New York. There was a piece of paper in his hand. I looked at it. It carried an address, 1392 Squirrel Hill. I put the paper in my pocket. Then I heard the outer office door open, and a feminine voice said,
"Is this Mr. Rogue's office?"
I jumped to my feet and ran out there, closing the door behind me. There was a girl standing by the desk talking to Betty, a dark girl. She had a figure with enough O's in it to put it in the million-dollar column, and a face to match. Betty said,
"This is Mr. Rogue. Where's my husband?"
"Well, I'm sure I don't know. What's his name?"
"Charles McDonald. He's here. I saw him come in."
"That's very interesting. Excuse me a moment. Betty, are they on their way?"
"Yes, both of them."
"Thanks. Now, Mrs. McDonald, what makes you think your husband is here?"
"I saw him come in here."
"You were on the elevator with him?"
"No. I just happened to be passing on the street. I saw Charles and spoke to him. He didn't even look at me. He walked right by. I couldn't understand it. He looked sick. I saw him come into this building. I followed him in."
"Now, where have you been all this time?"
"I missed his elevator. Why are you questioning me like this? I know he's here. I want to see him."
"Well, if you missed his elevator, what makes you think he's here? This is a big building, you know."
"I waited for his elevator to come back to the ground floor. I talked to the operator. He remembered my husband and told me that Charles had asked for your office. Where is he, Mr. Rogue? Where is he?"
"Mrs. McDonald, would you just please have a chair? He's here all right, but he's busy. You'll have to wait." "Oh, hello, Lieutenant Urban. Come in."
"Well, Rogue, what goes on? Where's the..."
"Urban, I want to see you in the next office. Follow me, will you?"
"Well, he's sure dead. How did it happen, Rogie?"
"I'll tell you all I know. He came in here looking pretty sick. I thought he'd been drinking. That long top coat he had on covered the fact that he was bleeding to death. I told him to come in here and wait. I came in about 2 minutes later, just as he pitched forward out of his chair and died. That's when I called you, or had Betty call you. She was here when he came in, saw the whole thing."
"Looks like a 38 caliber job. Two around the heart."
"His name is Charles McDonald, and he's from New York City."
"Oh, that's interesting. Who's the girl outside with Callahan?"
"His wife."
"Well, where does she fit in here?"
"Well, she..."
"McDonald, you can't go in there."
"I want to see Mr. Rogue."
"Sit down."
"I'm going in there."
"No, Mr. McDonald, no, you can't go in
there." "I know he's in there. I'm going in."
Well, when that girl saw Charles McDonald lying there, as dead as yesterday's beer, she folded up right over him like a dropped piece of string. Urban and Betty and I were still working over when the medical examiner and the technical squad from Homicide showed up. We picked her up, carried her into the outer office, and as soon as she came to, Betty gave her a glass of water, which she sipped nervously when Urban started throwing questions at her like baseballs.
"Mrs. McDonald, I'm sorry to have to question you at this time. Will you please put that glass down and listen to me? Now, your husband was obviously murdered. I have to have the information."
"I don't know who could have done it. My husband was a businessman. He wasn't mixed up in anything that could have caused his murder."
"Now, what kind of business was your husband in?"
"He was in the jewelry business. Manager of a big store in New York."
"Mm-hmm.
Richard,
what was your address
in New York?" "I have to get back to the paper. I have to get the story in."
"Okay, wait a minute, and I'll walk out in the hall with you."
"All right, come on."
"Where are you going, Rogie?"
"I'm taking Betty to a cab. I'll be back."
"See that you are."
"Come on."
"Doing pulling me along like this? I have high heels on."
"I'm in a hurry, baby."
"But you told Lieutenant Urban you'd be right back."
"I told him I'd be back, and I will. My rent's paid for another month."
"Well, where are you going?"
"To do a little investigating. That's what it says in my card, investigator. Now, look, honey, when we get downstairs, I'm going to have to leave you. I'll see you tonight here at the office at 7 o'clock.
Going down. Hello, Mr. Rogue."
"Hi, Shorty. Drop this thing, will you? I'm in a hurry." I shot out of that building like a bat out of a belfry and jumped into a cab. I slipped the cab jockey a bill that made his eyes pop open like dropped eggs and told him he could keep it if he could get me to 1392 Squirrel Hill in 5 minutes. That's the address I found in Charles McDonald's hand. We broke every law but the 18th Amendment the next 4 minutes and 50 seconds, and I jumped out of the cab, hit the front steps of that big, deserted-looking old house in the dead run. The door was ajar, so I took my gun out of its shoulder holster, put it in my side coat pocket, and walked right in. into a blackjack.
Oh!
My glazed eyes told my brain there was a dead man lying there. And then my head hit one of the stars which were surrounding me. And the star exploded with a blinding flash. I felt myself flying upward at a speed that made me dizzy. I was grabbing at the tails of comets, trying to break my speed, but nothing could stop me. I looked down at the earth, and I seemed to be looking through the wrong end of a telescope. It was a little round ball, that's all. I couldn't get my breath. I fought for it. And then my lungs seemed to explode, and everything was peaceful. I opened my eyes, and I was on Cloud 8, my home away from home. Ugor was sitting there, dangling his little short legs over eternity and combing his long white beard with his stubby fingers.
Hello, Rogie. Been using your head for a blackjack backstop again, huh?
Oh, never mind the cracks. I feel awful. Who did it?
Some big guy I never saw before.
Oh, but why would he want to hit me?
Well, you must have been interfering in his business, Chiefy.
Yeah, I know it. What was I doing there? I'm a little foggy.
Well, you went there because it was the address that was printed on that piece of paper you found in Charles McDonald's hand. Remember?
Oh, yeah. Hey, I better get downstairs. I got work to do. Help me over the side, will you, Ugor?
Oh, look, Rogie. There's no dough in this case for you. Why don't you get out of it? You want to get yourself killed for free?
I'll get out of it if I ever get back downstairs. Give me a shove, will you? I'm going down there.
Okay, Chiefy. But take care of yourself now. So long, Rogie.
Opened one eye carefully. Then I closed it again so fast that I was afraid the guy who was watching me would hear it snap. He was a big man, and his eyes were the blue of ice cubes. Full of ice cubes with floodlights behind them. Hot ice. One of his hands was holding a gun, and the gun was pointed right where my heart would have been if it hadn't been in my throat.
No use playing possum now, Mr. Rose. Mm. No, indeed. Mm. I am aware that you have returned to consciousness.
Oh, who are you?
My name is Moore. Now come, Mr. Rogue. I realize that you undoubtedly have a headache, probably a splitting headache, and I'm regretful. But we can finish our business in just a moment if you'll sit up and talk with me.
Okay, I'll try.
Excellent. Now, Mr. Rogue, where is it?
Where is what?
Now, time is of the essence. Let us not waste it. You know what I'm speaking of. The Star of Savoy. Where is it?
You have to believe me. I don't know whether you're talking about a burlesque dancer, passenger liner, or a military decoration. What is the Star of Savoy, and why am I supposed to know something about it?
You're jesting, of course.
Oh, believe me, I never jest with a head like this. Look, Mister, you got the wrong number. Do you think I killed this man here?
Oh, indeed I don't. He was killed by a man named Charles MacDonald. You know Mr. MacDonald, of course.
Oh, vaguely, yes. He was dead when I met him.
Delightful sense of humor. I always admire a man with a sense of humor.
Good. Well, then, look, I am going to get out of here.
That's possible. Entirely possible. After you tell me where I may find the Star of Savoy, Mr. Rhodes.
I don't know. I don't know anything about it. Don't even know what it is.
It's a large diamond, Mr. Rogue. One of the largest in the world. Formerly owned by the Hohenzollern family. Recently the property of a New York collector of famous jewels. It's a magnificent jewel, Rogue. Magnificent. Where is it?
I don't know. I suppose you think I came here after it.
Oh, I wouldn't know about that, Mr. Rogue. But you say you met my friend Charles MacDonald after he was dead. Very cleverly put. But when MacDonald left here, he went from here directly to your office. He was carrying the Star of Savoy in his coat. I know that to be true. I was following him.
Well, we searched him, the police and I. He didn't have the Star of Savoy or any other diamond over a carat anyplace on him. That's the truth. Only thing I found on him was this address. That's why I came here.
That's very strange. Yes, quite baffling. Have you met a strikingly beautiful girl? Tall, dark black hair, brown eyes, very appealing.
You mean MacDonald's wife?
Well, yes, MacDonald's wife. You've met her?
She was at my office when he died. Who is this stiff here?
A former partner of mine. He was attempting to double-cross me, poor fellow. You see, Rogue, he and I had a market for the Star of Savoy, a very fine market. That's why we hoped to get it from Mr. MacDonald today. MacDonald was most unreasonable, most unreasonable. Of course, I intend to continue in my efforts to acquire the Star of Savoy. This dark young lady, Mrs. MacDonald, was she alone with him at any time? Either while he was alive or after his death?
Well, no. She came into my office and saw that he was dead and fainted.
Oh, I see. Well, Mr. Rogue, I'm inclined to believe your story about knowing nothing about my diamond. I think I'll be running along. But just to make sure that you don't use your meager talents to pursue me, I'll have to... Oh!
Well, what had started out to be a lovely, lucid day had certainly turned out to be as ugly and mad as a giraffe with a sore throat. The date I had with Betty Callahan had been interrupted by a stranger walking into my office and dropping dead of predigested murder. I got knocked silly and came to find a guy named Moore politely annoyed with me about a diamond I'd never seen. So annoyed with me, in fact, that he was determined to kick my teeth out. I saw that big shoe swing from my jaw and I ducked right into it. Oh, it would have been so easy for me to pass out again. But I fought it. I couldn't. I needed the time. I vaguely heard the fading footsteps of Mr. Moore through the aura of pain which was surrounding me like a fog. And after he'd faded out, I sat there for a while. Then I got to my hands and knees and crawled until my head cleared a little. When I got to my feet, I ran out of the house, grabbed a cab for the Park Crest Hotel. I thought I'd find Moore there looking for Mrs. MacDonald. Oh, I must have looked like a hit-and-run victim as I approached the very proper clerk. He backed away, but I reached across the counter and grabbed him.
Let go of me.
I want some information. I want it fast. What room is Mrs. Charles MacDonald of New York City in?
Mrs. MacDonald?
Stop stalling. What's her room number?
We have a Mr. MacDonald, but there is no Mrs. MacDonald. His wife is in New York.
How do you know that?
I sent a wire to her for him last night. There's no Mrs. MacDonald out here. And now let me go before I call the house officer.
I remembered then... Mr. Moore had hesitated when I pegged that tall, dark girl as Mrs. MacDonald. That girl was an imposter. My head was still doing the Virginia reel with variations on the turns, but I couldn't slow up now. In spite of the racket inside my skull, I was thinking straight and clearly. I ran to my office. It was only a block. And I got that glass that Mrs. MacDonald had been twirling in her fingers as Urban questioned her. I took it down to police headquarters and asked the sergeant of the fingerprint bureau to dust it for prints and telephoto the prints to the FBI in Washington. I told him he could find me in my office. I went back to my office and sank into my swivel chair and let sleep take over.
Honey, you look so awful.
Oh, Betty, how? Hello, baby. What are you doing here?
It's 7 o'clock, Richard. You told me to meet you here at 7 o'clock.
Seven? Uh-huh. Oh, seven it is? Oh, hey, what about those fingerprints?
Fingerprints?
Yeah, excuse me a minute, baby. I got to call the identification bureau.
You should be in a hospital. Oh, Richard, you can't take me to dinner looking like that.
Oh, honey, think how I feel.
Bureau. Sergeant James.
Sergeant, this is Richard Rogue. Did you get an answer from the FBI on those prints I gave you?
Yeah, it just came in, Rogue. They belong to a girl named Alice Ryan. 3 years ago, when they took them at the aircraft company where she worked, She lived at 4435 Ethel Avenue in North Hollywood.
Any criminal record?
Arrested once in a confidence rap 4 years ago. Dismissed for lack of evidence.
Thanks, Dodge. I owe you a cigar. Come on, Betty. We're going to go to North Hollywood. I'll explain why in a cab. Come on.
No, Alice does not live here anymore. She moved into Los Angeles about 7 months ago when she quit her job at the airplane factory.
Did she leave a forwarding address?
Oh, yes, I'll get it for you. Just a minute. You think she has the diamond, don't you, Richard?
Sure. She lifted it off McDonald's body when she fainted over him.
Oh, how awful. Here it is. It is a long drive from here in Los Angeles.
Thanks.
Ryan, no, she doesn't live here anymore. She came into money or something. She lives in Hollywood now.
Do you know her address there?
Big guy around here after an hour ago. It's North Serrano. Well, wait a minute, I'll get it for you.
A big man. That's the man?
Yeah, that's the man. He has an hour's head start.
Here it is. I wrote it down for you.
Oh, thank you, sir. Okay, now, Betty. Now, ring the bell and then stand back. Clear back against the wall and stay away from the windows.
All right, Richard. You take care of yourself now.
I always do. Stand where you are, and I'll go knock on the door.
All right.
You stay right there, Betty. I'm going to try the door. Now, stay where you are.
I will.
Come in. Come in, Mr. Rogue, and don't attempt to be clever because you present a beautiful target there in the doorway.
Where's Alice Ryan?
She's here. Drop your gun, please, Mr. Rogue. I can see you, you know. I have a bit of advantage. Drop your gun, Mr. Rogue. Close the door, Mr. Rogue. Now that I've turned the light on, you can see that you have found Alice Ryan.
Oh, brother.
Yes. I'm sorry. I was forced to eliminate her, Mr. Rogue. She was most unreasonable about giving me the Star of Savoy. She chose to pit her ordinary brain against my genius in this race to see who would be the possessor of the stone after Charles MacDonald was eliminated. And now, Mr. Rogue, you find yourself in much the same position.
Yeah, I guess I'm not very smart. You have the diamond?
Indeed, I have. And I think perhaps you deserve a glimpse of it. There. Is that not the most inspiring sight you ever seen, Mr. Rogue? Look at it, glistening there. 100 people have died, I would imagine, Mr. Rogue, in the history of this stone. Yes, at least 100. I have spent the last 10 years scheming, contriving, bribing, stealing to get this lovely thing. And now, Mr. Rogue, it's mine.
Yeah, you got it. What are you going to do with it? Just sit there and look at it?
I can get $1 million for it. $1 million in cold cash and no questions asked. $1 million. I'm not at all sure that that is enough, Mr. Rogue. And now, I'm afraid I'm going to be forced, regretfully, to remove you.
There was cold murder in the ice-blue eyes that were looking into mine. Moore was enjoying every breath of my last few minutes on Earth. He was waiting for me to break. And all the time, he was talking in that cultured iceberg voice. Then I saw Betty. She was hugging the wall in the next room, creeping silently toward the killer. I wanted to shout at her. To shout at her, to tell her to go away. And then...
Richard! Richard, are you all right?
Yeah, I knocked his gun up the air when you scared him silly. Oh, Betty, Betty, bless your little pointed head, but why did you do it? Betty, well, of all the times to faint, isn't that just like a woman? Well, the police took it from there, and the story was pretty plain. Moore was the head of a gang of international jewel thieves, consisting of the man I found dead on Squirrel Hill, Alice with the dark black hair, and himself. They had offered Charles MacDonald a fortune to steal the Star of Savoy from the Park Avenue establishment where he was employed and where it was on exhibition. They planned to kill him when he delivered the stone. But the trio triple-crossed themselves, and finally only Moore remained alive, which was a temporary thing, because Moore soon paid the final score for the murders he committed. And, well, I got a $5,000 reward for breaking the case. $5,000 for just getting batted around a little. Isn't bad, is it, huh? I split the reward with Betty Callahan, who certainly saved my life. And she went right out and spent her half on a fur cape. You know, women should never have money. They don't know how to handle it. Of course, the first time she wore the cape, she looked so lovely that I took her to the races and lost my half on a horse named Investigator. Oh, well, money isn't as important as true love, but there's a lot more of it. You know what I mean? This is Dick Powell again, ladies and gentlemen. It's awfully nice to meet you on a new network. I hope you enjoyed our stories tonight. Ray Buffum wrote it. Leif Stevens composed and conducted the music, and Dee Engelbach produced and directed.
Rogues Gallery on Tuned to Yesterday, an episode from June 23rd, 1946 on NBC. You're listening to An Hour of Mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Next, Frank Lovejoy stars as reporter Randy Stone in Nightbeat with co-star William Conrad, who you'll soon hear and may even recognize as the voice of Marshal Matt Dillon from Gunsmoke. At the time of this episode, Gunsmoke had not come to fruition, but William Conrad was in the employ of many radio shows at the time on all major networks like yours truly, Johnny Dollar, Escape, and the radio show Rocky Jordan, which he appeared in a week after this next broadcast from June 12, 1950.
Wheaties presents Nightbeat. On stage tonight, transcribed from Hollywood, Nightbeat, another in the Wheaties big parade of exciting half-hour presentations. Nightbeat.
Hi, this is Randy Stone. I cover the Nightbeat for the Chicago Star. Stories start in many different ways. This one began when I bumped into a wonderful legend out of the past and watched that legend die before my eyes.
Nightbeat, starring Frank Lovejoy as Randy Stone.
You know, I guess the one thing that makes a newspaper guy like me different from any other working stiff is that while a bookkeeper works with numbers, carpenter deals in wood, and the miner sweats over coal, a newspaper man, well, all he works with is people. What makes them laugh and dance in the street, what makes them cry in the night. But just the same, like most kinds of work, this has its occupational hazards, too. Being a newspaper man doesn't give you painter's colic or housemaid's knee, but sometimes it can sure do some lousy things to your heart. It was my night off. I had a date with a little blonde at the information desk. You know, the girl who tells you where to go after you tell her what you're looking for. I finally talked her into going dancing. I was supposed to pick her up at 9 o'clock. Only here it was 8:30, and I was still trying to find a flower shop to buy her a corsage. I'd walked to the edge of Skid Row when I finally spotted this place, a little florist shop in the center of a shabby office building. Looking through the window, I saw a gray-haired old lady pinning a boutonniere on the lapel of a chunky fellow in a shiny blue serge. As I came through the front door, the fellow spun around like he was expecting the worst.
Oh.
Will you hold still so I can get this flower in place?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Dunlap. I'm expecting somebody. I thought maybe this fellow might be the one.
All right. Now, you just stay quiet. I'll be with you in a moment, sir.
All right, there's no hurry. No hurry at all.
There now. Isn't that beautiful? My husband set it aside especially for you.
Tell your husband thanks. I don't know. No matter how punk I feel, if I get a fresh flower in my lapel, it picks me up better than a shot of raw gin. How much do I owe you?
50 cents.
Here you are. Oh.
Oh, I'll pick it up. You seem upset tonight. This person you're going to meet must be quite important.
Yeah, he sure is. He's the man who's going to put me out of my misery.
What?
Sure. Tell your husband next time I need a flower, he'd better make it a nice white lily. Goodbye.
Ah, that fella's sure upset.
Oh, poor Tom Paxton. I've seen him like this before. He's just had a wee bit too much to drink, I'm afraid.
Tom Paxton? No.
Huh?
The rose in his lapel used to be his trademark.
Oh, do you know Tom?
Well, if he's the same one, I was never that lucky. Best I could do was worship him from a distance.
Worship Tom?
Yeah, that sounds crazy, doesn't it? 10 years ago, when I was in college, Tom Paxton was the greatest football star we'd ever had. He was one of the greatest in the country. He was a legend.
Oh, well, it can't be the same man.
I don't know. Once you get over the shock, the resemblances there, and that rose in the lapel. I don't know, lady, but I'm going to find out. I went out the side door of the floor of the shop into the lobby. And there was Tom standing in the dark, pushing the button for the elevator. As I came up to him, he spun around again like it was part of an act that he always did on cue.
Are you following me?
Well, yes.
You weren't just shopping for flowers there, were you?
Hmm?
If you're Dixie, all right, don't play games with me. I'm tired of running away. I'm half bats. How much of it can I take?
Now, look, I'm Randy Stone. I heard the woman call you Tom Paxton. When I went to college, there was a Tom Paxton who was just about the greatest football player who ever lived.
What are you talking about? You got me mixed up with three other guys.
Well, this Tom Paxton was always sporting a flower in his lapel.
There's no law against that, is there? Now, go on, get out of here. Let me alone.
While we were talking, the light over the button of the self-operating elevator flashed on. The elevator was coming down. Well, if Tom Paxton didn't want me to bother him, I couldn't twist his arm. I turned to leave just as the elevator doors opened. Only instead of Tom stepping in, somebody else stepped out.
I was waiting for you, Paxton.
You're Dixie, aren't you?
Come again?
Aren't you?
Sure, that's where I got this southern accent.
Now, listen.
Come on. Somebody wants to see you.
Why doesn't the syndicate give me a break? Why don't they give me a chance to pay up?
I said come on.
Now, wait a minute, Buster.
You ain't invited, sport. This is one of them small affairs. Paxton, this gun in my pocket, it ain't one of them gadgets you pull the trigger and a cigarette pops out. Come on.
Tom and the mug went out to a small black sedan parked at the curb. As the car raced down the street, I ran across the lobby into Dunlop's flower shop and called the police. When the squad car arrived, I told the boys what little I knew. We found Tom's office on the fourth floor. It told me more about his life since he left college than a 600-page biography. A battered couch, a filing cabinet with nothing filed away except a half-empty bottle of gin, and a beaten-up desk that gave up a couple of old racing forms. And then on the wall behind the desk, I saw something that really grabbed my heart. A picture of the college football team, with Tom right in front with a pigskin in his arms, smiling defiantly like nothing bad could ever happen to him. I hung around after the police left. The picture made me feel low. I wondered how many beatings you had to take to go from All-American to Skid Row to maybe the county morgue. Then the office door opened, and Tom was standing in the doorway. Only he looked different. He didn't seem to be so frightened anymore.
Well, I hear there were cops all over the place. What are you trying to do, get me some publicity?
Did Dixie give you a stay of execution?
No, that wasn't Dixie. Just one of Frank Burr's tough guys.
Burr, the big shot political?
Yeah, that's right. Had a little assignment for yours truly.
Oh, yeah? How many times do you have to vote for him?
Oh, it's nothing like that. I'm going to conduct a little investigation. Yeah, so you remembered the old halfback, huh?
I thought you didn't know what I was talking about.
Oh, well, I had a lot on my mind downstairs. Wasn't in any mood to chew the fat. Yeah, what are you doing these days?
I work on a newspaper.
Oh, is that so?
Uh-huh.
Well, me, like you see, I went into the investigating game. It's not much of an office, but if big shots like Burr come to me, I guess it's not so bad, huh?
No, I guess not.
Say, this fella Dixie I mentioned, I don't want you to get any funny ideas about him. I just gambled a little over my head, you know, like anybody does now and then. Well, I owe the syndicate a few $1,000, so they think they can scare me by putting their hatchet men on my trail. Only if you remember Tom Paxton, you know he don't scare so easy. Right?
That's right.
Yeah, that reminds me. I better call the boys right now and tell them I'll settle up at the end of the week. You know, I don't want them losing any sleep on my account.
Well, I'll be going, Tom.
No, kid. Stick around. I'd like to talk to you, kid. About old times, eh?
All right, okay, Tom.
Hello, Jack. Hiya, kid. This is Tom Paxton. Say, look, baby, I got some good news for you. I'll be able to settle with you boys at the end of the week. Well, I know I have, but this time it's on the level. Well, now, wait a minute, Jack. Don't hang up on me. Well, now, give me a break, baby. 3 days? Oh, but I can't do the job in 3 days. No, wait, please, don't hang up. Okay. 3 days. Only tell Dixie to lay off. Yeah. Thanks, Jack. Thanks a lot. 3 days.
How am I going to find him in 3 days?
Tom, if there's anything I can do...
What? Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's something you can do. You can clear out of here. So you found me out, huh? That make you feel good or something?
Oh, now, look.
Maybe if you'd taken the beatings I have, maybe if you'd been crossed up, stabbed in the back, slugged, cheated as many times as I have, you... Oh, what am I telling you for? Go on, get out of here.
Sure thing. So long, Tom.
No, wait a minute.
Yeah?
Look, you being a reporter, you could get into records I couldn't even touch, couldn't you?
Well, I think so.
Look, if I had a week, I could do it on my own, but I've got to find him in 3 days.
Who do you have to find in 3 days?
Look, Stone, I'm not going to kid with you anymore. I've got to make good on this job Berg gave me. I've got to get that fee. If I don't, this guy, Dixie, will...
Who is this guy, Dixie?
Well, that's what drives me nuts. Nobody knows, only the syndicate.
Well, why don't you go to the police?
No. Cops are out of my line. If I could clean this job up in 3 days, Burr will pay me $5,000 and I'll be all right. That's like I've always said. All you need in life is one good break. And after that, you can roll on your own.
Well, what about Burr?
Well, for a big shot, he's sure plenty scared. Says the newspaper's trying to destroy him.
Oh, so?
So the only way they can do it is to find somebody named John Durand.
I never heard of him.
Nobody, but not to Burr.
Well, what does Durand look like?
Well, Burr wouldn't know what he looks like today. He hasn't seen him for 25 years. I've only got one thing to go on.
Now, what's that?
John Durand is a blind man.
A big shot like Burr afraid of a helpless blind man?
Afraid? Burr's as frightened of that blind man, John Durand, as I am of my unknown pal, Dixie.
Tom and I started work the next morning, right after he picked up a fresh, sweet-smelling rose from Mr. and Mrs. Dunlop's florist shop in the lobby. Funny, but for Tom, a flower in his lapel was like a shot of Benzedrine. After that, we split up. I went down to the paper to have a talk with a political editor. Yes, everyone interested in clean government was trying to wash that Burr right out of their hair. But so far, nothing definite had turned up against him. Only a funny blank space in Burr's biography, a blank space that happened 25 years ago. And I got that ever-loving jackpot feeling. 25 years ago, that's when John Durand, the blind man, entered the picture. Tom and I had to find that blind man, and we had 3 days.
Randy, I'm calling from City Hall. I've checked all the city directories. No John Durand.
Oh, that's great. I visited every agency that helps the blind. Nobody's ever heard of him.
Well, what are we going to do, Randy?
What else can we do? We keep looking. He's not on any credit report. His name's never appeared on any police blotter.
Well, we're running out of time.
Well, nothing to do but keep looking.
I've been going through the records over at the county building. I can't find a trace.
We've got only one day left, Randy. The syndicate gave me till midnight tomorrow. What are we going to do?
What we've been doing right along. Keep looking.
The third day, we started making the rounds of all the hoodlum hangouts. The bars, the pool halls, the mangy little side street flop houses. I took one section of the city and Tom took the other. And late that night in one of those flop houses, I got the shock of my sweet life.
No, nobody named John Durand ever stopped here.
Well, I thought he might have stayed here under a phony name. He's a blind guy.
Yeah, I know all about him, mister.
You what?
What did this poor sucker do anyhow? Every hoodlum I know is looking for him.
What are you talking about?
Just what I said. Every guy in town who'll cut a throat to earn a buck is looking for John Durand.
It was after 9 p.m. when I got back to Tom's office to break the news to him. Poor guy, he thought Burr had given him an exclusive assignment. And all the time, Burr had set up a private manhunt. He'd unleashed every mad dog in town to track down John Durand. When I got to the office, the door was open, but Tom wasn't around. I sat down to wait for him, and the phone started ringing. Hello?
I'd like to speak to Mr. Paxton.
Well, he's not around right now. Any message?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
You can tell Mr. Paxton that he can stop his search for John Durand as of now.
Does that mean you found him?
Oh, you know about it, eh?
Oh, yes, I'm helping Paxton. Did you find Durand?
No. But I know where I can find him when I want to.
I see. But then I guess that winds things up.
Yes. Tell Mr. Paxton, will you please?
Yeah, I'll look, as long as it's all over with. Why have you been so anxious to catch Durand? After all, he's only a blind man, and I... Mm-hmm. I'll ask a silly question, you get a silly answer. I had
just hung up the phone thinking, poor Tom, now there's no way out for him. His 3 days were just about all washed up. Now there was nobody left but his friend Dixie. And then, like I'd said a magic word or something, the door to Tom's office started slowly opening. Tom came in leading a little old guy with smoked glasses and a white cane. Tom, you found him. You found Durant.
I should be so lucky. No, this is Mr. Graham, one of the directors of the Institute for the Blind.
Hello.
How do you do?
I'm going batty, banging my head against walls. I figured maybe Mr. Graham might give us a lead. Oh, Mr. Graham, this is Randy Stone.
How do you do, sir? I hope I can be of service.
Oh, thank you, but I'm afraid it's too late, Mr. Graham.
Too late? What do you mean?
A bird just called. He's found Durand. You can forget that $5,000 fee. You're fired.
And Dixie comes into the picture again. The syndicate gave me only until tonight.
Yeah, excuse me while I make a call.
Who are you calling?
About 2,000 cops.
Hang up the phone, Randy.
What are you talking about? You need them now.
Hang it up.
Don't be nuts.
All right, I'll hang it up for you.
Now, what's that for?
Call in the cops. Big deal. Maybe it would delay my trip to the morgue, but if that's the best I can get, it's no soap.
The cops would protect you?
Sure, for a week, 2 weeks, maybe even a month. But then what? Dixie would still be waiting. He's never missed an appointment.
They'd pick him up before he reached you. There's a couple of small laws about killing people.
How would they pick him up? They wouldn't even know who to look for.
Gentlemen, I seem to be intruding. If one of you will lead me to the elevator, I...
Oh. You lead him, Randy. Then you get on the elevator right with him. Thanks for the try.
Oh, now, wait a minute.
Beat it, will you? I'm expecting a guest.
Now, Mr. Graham, before we leave, for my own amazement, I want to ask you something.
Yes?
Can you think of any reason why a powerful man like Burris should be afraid of a helpless blind man?
Well, of course, that's hard to say.
Randy, will you get out of here, the both of you?
Unless, of course, the man saw something just before he went blind that would incriminate Mr. Burr.
Hmm?
Yes, you see, the blind never forget the last thing they see before they go blind. It stays alive in their mind until the moment they die.
Well, then, if Durand had been a witness to a crime Burr committed and then went blind...
That would indeed make him the greatest possible menace to Burr.
Well, then that's it.
Hooray for our side. A lot of good it does me now.
I can tell you how it was when I went blind. It happened quite suddenly, as the doctor said it would. I was out in the country with my family. Wildflowers everywhere. And now that my blindness has made me so overly sensitive to the lovely scent of flowers, the picture is even more real. You know, it's a strange thing about flowers.
The blind man kept talking softly, more to himself than to us. Tom had spun his swivel chair around so that he was looking out of the window. The back of his shirt collar was soaking wet. I knew the pressure was building up inside him like steam in a boiler. Absently, he'd been taking the ever-present flower from his lapel, and he was tearing it apart with nervous fingers. And then Tom's back stiffened. He was staring through the window down at the dark street. I looked over his shoulder. A big car had stopped a short way down the street. A heavy-set, well-dressed man had stepped out. As he passed under the street lamp in front of the flower shop, I recognized him from his pictures.
Burr. It's Frank Burr.
Tom's voice sounded cockeyed. I looked at him. His face was falling to pieces like an overripe melon. He was looking at the flower he'd taken from his lapel.
Mrs. Dunlap, she won't like what I'm doing to her flower. Always so proud because her husband could select sweet-scented flowers. Graham, what did you say before? Now that my blindness has made me sensitive to the scent of flowers...
Yes, I...
Mr. Dunlap, the florist.
I never had a good look at him. He was always puttering around and back.
You think
that... I know. John Durand was always just downstairs in the lobby. And there's still time for me, Randy. There's still time.
Tom raced for the door of his office. He pulled a gun out of his coat. I followed him. He went to the elevator, pressed the button a couple of times, and then decided to take the stairs instead. He looked back at me, chasing after him, and waved me back. He started down the stairs two at a time. I caught up with him at the second landing. I grabbed his shoulders. He tried to tear himself away.
Let me go, Randy. Let me go.
What do you mean there's still time? What are you going to do down there?
Randy, I'm telling you to let me go.
Answer me. What are you going to do?
Sure, I'll answer. You're overboard. What do you think Burr was going to pay me $5,000 for? Just to give him Durand's address so he could send him nasty letters? No, there was one other little item I didn't tell you about. I not only had to find Durand, I had to make sure nobody else found him. I had to kill him.
Oh, Tom, you're kidding. A helpless blind man?
Oh, Burr thinks I'm the man for the job. He told me I was the ideal choice.
Tom, you're not that kind of a man.
Who says so? You think this is still the old football team with a lot of nice rules so nobody gets hurt too bad? This is the jungle, Rover Boy. It's dog eat dog all the way down the line. Now let me go.
No.
I said let me go.
He broke away and took off the stairs again. But Tom had put on a lot of fat since college days, and walking the night beat had kept me lean. I caught up with him just as we reached the lobby.
Randy, I'm telling you to lay off of me. Now, leave me alone.
You're going to listen to reason.
All you need is one good break. Well, this is mine, and I'm going to take it. Now, let me go.
You're crazy. I can't let you do it.
You'll have to let me do it, Randy. You're just going to have to let me do it.
Tom brought the gun barrel down on my head. My knees turned to ginger beer. I reached for the wall to keep from falling, but the wall fell right with me. I tried to cry out, but all I could manage was a wheeze. Helplessly, I watched Tom, with the gun still in his hand, go through the lobby entrance into the florist shop.
Oh, Tom! What on earth are you doing with that gun?
At that moment, the front door opened too, and Mr. Burr came into the shop also carrying a gun.
Don't do that!
What a spot for a chorus of auld lang syne.
What's going on? Mr. Paxton, what is this?
Burr, is the job still mine?
A smug little smile crossed Burr's face as he put his own gun away.
Sure, why not, Paxton? A deal's a deal. He's in back working on his flowers. But it'll have to be her, too.
Oh!
Okay. Okay.
No! Please! Tom!
Tom raised his gun as old Lady Durand started running for her husband. And then Tom seemed to hesitate, like something was going through his mind.
Go on. What are you waiting for?
Maybe Tom was thinking about his last 10 years on Skid Row when he'd never done one decent thing. And maybe he thought it was time to start.
Go ahead and get it over with, Paxton.
Suddenly, Tom swung the gun away from the cowering Durands and began shooting. There wasn't even time for that smug smile to leave Burr's face as Burr slowly crumbled to the floor. After that, everything started getting foggy for me. By the time the police arrived and splashed cold water on my face, Tom had gotten away, disappeared into the night. Burr was dead, and now John Durand wasn't afraid to talk. 25 years before, Burr had been a punk in the rackets. There'd been a bombing. One man killed, John Durand blinded. And the picture Durand carried in his mind, the last thing he saw before the lights went out forever, was Burr throwing that bomb. After that, Durand was afraid Burr would try to finish the job, so he changed his name and went into hiding. I told the cops about the gambling syndicate that had been hounding Tom, and they went after the boys. And all in all, it was quite an evening. Then around 3:30 in the morning, while I was sitting up in my office trying to bat out my night beat story, my telephone started ringing. Yeah?
Randy, this is Tom.
Tom, hey, where are you?
Never mind, I'm okay. I just wanted to let you know you were pretty good to me, kid.
Listen, every cop in the city's looking for you.
Well, they can look until Christmas. It won't do them any good. I've got a hideout that they couldn't find with radar.
How come?
It's like I always said, all you need is one good break. I got mine right out of a clear blue sky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, real square. Met him at a bar, didn't know where to turn. This guy buys me a drink, says I look like I can stand a good meal and a place to sleep. He thinks I just blew into town and I'm down and out. Now he says I can stay here as long as I like. He's in the next room, so I gotta make this call short.
Tom, I tell you, you're crazy for hiding out. The police will give you a break.
Now, says who?
I'm telling you they will.
And even if they did, what about the syndicate? What about Dixie?
There isn't any more syndicate. Most of those hoodlums are already sitting in jail.
What? Dixie, too?
No, but they'll have him soon enough. Now they've got a description of him. They know who to look for.
Look, I gotta hang up. This guy's liable to pop in any second, but just for the records, what does Dixie look like?
He's an ordinary fella. He wears glasses, even. He's got gray hair. Looks more like an insurance man than a hoodlum.
Dixie looks like that.
The only two distinguishing marks, according to the police, is that thumb is missing from his left hand.
Randy, has he got a white scar under his eye?
How did you know that?
Look, Randy, the guy that took me to this hideout, the guy that gave me the break, he's Dixie.
What? Where are you? Quick, tell me.
Oh, he's coming, Randy.
Tom.
Tom.
Operator. Yeah. Like Tom always said, all you need is one good break. Tomorrow? Sure, a nice, pleasant morrow coming right up. Well, maybe not so pleasant. Tom had been dead a long time before Dixie caught up with him. Tom had died when he found out he wasn't always going to be a hero, the guy on top of the heap. What is there about people that they've got to be number one or they won't play? What's so bad about being number two or number three? Why does life have to be one great victory after another? What's so fancy about us that we can't afford to fall on our face every so often? The fellow who said, "God, give me the strength to fail," really had something. And besides, not making the top of the heap has its compensations, too. It's a lot less lonely down here among us also, Rand. Copy, boy.
You are listening to Night Beat on the Wheaties Big Parade. Night Beat, starring Frank Lovejoy, is produced and directed by Warren Lewis. Written and edited by Larry Marcus. Music by Frank Worth. The part of Tom was played by Bill Conrad. Others in tonight's cast were Jeanette Nolan, Ted Von Eltz, and Norman Field. Listen next week at this same time and every week as Randy Stone searches through the city for the strange stories waiting for him in the darkness.
And this is the Wheaties man, Frank Martin, inviting you to listen also on Tuesday, that's tomorrow night, to the Penny Singleton Show on the Wheaties Big Parade. See you then.
Nightbeat came to you transcribed from Hollywood.
Nightbeat on Tuned to Yesterday from June 12th, 1950 on NBC. And that brings to a close this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVeonier. Thanks for tuning in.